Case number 21-1048 et al. Don't Waste Michigan et al. Petitioners versus U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission and United States of America. Ms. Guerin for the petitioner Beyond Nuclear Inc. Mr. Taylor for the petitioners Don't Waste Michigan et al. Mr. Tanner for the petitioner Fasken Land and Minerals Limited. Mr. Averback for the respondents. Mr. Fack for the intervener.
Ms. Guerin, before you begin, I'd just like to note that today marks the first day of sitting for our newest colleague, Florence Pan. Judge Pan, welcome to the D.C. Circuit.
Thank you.
Please proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Diane Curran. I'm here for Beyond Nuclear. With me on the front row is my co-counsel, Judy Goldstein. I'd like to take 7 minutes for my opening argument. In this case, all parties agree that the NRC issued a license that would violate the Nuclear Waste Policy Act if one of its conditions were fulfilled by allowing the licensee to rely on contracts with the U.S. Department of Energy to take federal ownership and financial responsibility for interim spent fuel stored at the licensee's private facility before the opening of a federal repository for permanent disposal. The only issue before this court is whether you should disregard the plain terms of the license condition as suggested by the NRC based on extraneous promises by the agency that fulfillment of the unlawful condition will never be carried out or allowed until Congress changes the law.
Forget about the extraneous promises. Let's just look at the face of the condition. It can be lawfully satisfied to the extent they are taking waste from privately owned waste for which a private entity has title.
That's absolutely true, Your Honor. And the license contains language that would allow private fuel interim storage partners to store federally owned spent fuel. It's our position that every word of this license has to be read. The license condition has to be fully enforceable at
the time you say that's your position, but what supports that? Could I finish my sentence? What is it that requires that every part of the license provision be enforceable? What is it that says you said you believe that all provisions of the license requirement must be enforceable, but what requires that? What do you cite for that proposition?
It is the private fuel storage case cited at page 8 of our reply brief. This is NRC's own jurisprudence that license conditions should be fulfillable at the time a license is approved. The point of a license condition is that it should be something that's easy to fulfill administratively, without having to question what the law might be.
Well, one of them is easy to fulfill, right?
I'm sorry?
One of them is easy to fulfill.
Yes, but all the words of the license must be...
Keep stating that, but I'm asking you what your authority is for that.
My authority is the Administrative Procedure Act and the NRC's own jurisprudence.
All right, let's start with the Administrative Procedure Act. What in that requires that every word be enforceable?
The NRC may not act contrary to the law. The administrative
but they're not acting.
Does
why
not,
are they acting contrary to the law? They say, what's contrary to law here?
They have approved a license that would allow the licensee to take unlawful conduct, that would approve unlawful conduct under the Nuclear Waste Policy Act. There's no temporal exception in the Administrative Procedure Act. It doesn't say if the law changes in the future, it's okay to put an unlawful condition in right now. The law has to be met at the time of licensing. That's basic APA requirement that the agency may not act contrary to law. And in this case, the NRC has admitted that its whole purpose here is to create a license that is valid now that does not need to be amended in the future. So they can't have it both ways. They can't tell you, well, you can disregard this unlawful language now, but it's going to be effective if and when the law changes so that this company can bid for NRC contracts without having to amend the license. That's at page 468 of the NRC's decision.
Suppose you're correct that the language in the license seeming to authorize arrangements for government-owned waste is unlawful. But there's still the other language authorizing arrangements with privately owned waste, and you have no argument against that. Why wouldn't we at most just excise the offending language and sever the rest? There's no reason why the provision can't operate as applied to privately owned waste.
Your Honor, it would certainly address our concerns about the language of the license if you were to sever the unlawful language, and that is a very well-accepted remedy in the court. The only problem here is that we also asked the NRC not to go ahead with this licensing proceeding in the first place because the license applicant was asking the NRC to take action that was contrary to the Nuclear Waste Policy Act. That would not be resolved, and we would ask you to declare that the NRC should not entertain license applications that are clearly unlawful. At the time, we asked the NRC to sever, to tell the applicant,
Excuse me. Why, if we granted the relief that Judge Katsas suggests, wouldn't that solve the problem completely?
It would not solve the problem.
Understand why.
That the NRC went ahead with a licensing proceeding. It took many years. That included an unlawful provision.
But if the unlawful provision is gone, what's left?
What's left is that the NRC has stated that it can issue a license that violates the law if the law changes. And that's where we get to the separation of powers problem.
Wait, before you go to separation of powers, let me just give you a slight modification of Judge Katz's question. Suppose we said, instead of excising that provision, suppose we said in our opinion that our opinion denying the petition is based on the assurances of the United States government that the unlawful provision will never be implemented. Wouldn't that do it too?
Your Honor, I still think that the law requires the NRC to issue a license that is lawful at the time of issue.
So then your answer to Judge Katz's question is no, right?
No.
It wouldn't satisfy.
No, but severing that provision would address the problem significantly.
May I ask a question? Ms. Curran, I think there might be a more simple way to approach this issue, and that is by focusing on the language of the contention that Beyond Nuclear filed. And so we are here reviewing the commission's decision to uphold the board's decision to reject the contention. And the words of the contention are as follows. The proceeding must be dismissed because the central premise of ISP's application that the U.S. Department of Energy will be responsible for the spent fuel that is transported to and stored at the proposed interim facility violates the NWPA. That was the contention. So on its face, doesn't this contention fail to raise a genuine dispute about a material issue? Because it says the central premise is that the DOE will be responsible for the spent fuel that is transported and stored at the proposed interim facility. It doesn't acknowledge the alternative way, and so it's not the central premise, and so this contention was correctly rejected. We don't have to get into any of these legal arguments about, you know, is this a legal thing or not. This contention fails.
But, Your Honor, the basis for the NRC's rejection of the contention was that there's no legal dispute that the license provision is currently unlawful. But the provision could never be fulfilled because the NRC and DOE would forbear from doing it. So that is
the commission said in its ruling, Beyond Nuclear has not shown error in the board's interpretation of the legal force of the disputed license condition. So why can't we just uphold that and say your contention fails?
Well, that's where the catch-22 comes in here. The NRC cites, when we file a hearing request, we have to show there's a dispute with a licensed applicant about what the law requires. And the NRC said, well, there's no dispute here. Everyone agrees that this license condition would be unlawful if under current law, but nobody's going to fulfill it or enforce it. So we were caught in a catch-22. We can't win that game.
Well, my understanding is in the board's decision, it noted that you filed your contention. The NRC said there's no dispute about the illegality of one portion of this. And you didn't amend your contention. So the contention that they rejected fails. You didn't amend your contention to take this into account. So what we have before us is a contention that was rejected and apparently properly so on its face. I don't know that we need to get into any of this other argument.
But the contention said that it was the central claim of the license application, and that is a proper reading, and the central claim is invalid, that the DOE can store spent fuel. We did not
argue. But it's not the central claim because there's an alternative way to fund this, which is through people or I guess, non-DOE title holders of spent fuel. So it's not the central premise, and your contention fails.
But the contention said that there is a claim in this license application that violates the Nuclear Waste Policy Act. We did not contest the lawful part of the license application that would allow private storage of spent fuel.
No, I understand what you intended, but you didn't say that in your contention, and the contention on its face, in my opinion, seems inadequate.
But, Your Honor, I also want to point out that we filed a motion to dismiss the entire proceeding, and the NRC referred it to the, you know, the NRC's hearing notice is supposed to, allow us an opportunity to litigate whether the license application fulfills the NRC's regulations for protection of health and safety. The issue of whether this license included a provision that violated the Nuclear Waste Policy Act was not really encompassed by the hearing notice. Therefore, we filed a motion to dismiss the proceeding, which the NRC refused to deal with. It would not rule on our claim and said, we're going to buck this to the licensing board, but our claim was not a dispute over whether ISP satisfied the NRC's safety requirements. It was a threshold claim that the entire proceeding was unlawful. And so we're asking you to rule on that threshold claim.
No, I understand. So, but are you conceding that if the contention fails, then all that's before us is your motion to dismiss based on this?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes.
No.
Thank you. We'll give you a few minutes on rebuttal. Now we, Mr. Taylor. Mr. Taylor.
May it please the court. I'm Wally Taylor. I'm representing the Sierra Club and a coalition led by Don't Waste Michigan. Terry Lodge actually represents Don't Waste Michigan, and he's here in spirit. But we jointly briefed this case at the court's direction, so I'm arguing for all of the parties. We raised several issues relative to the contentions we filed in the NRC adjudicative proceeding. We also filed separate petitions for review regarding the environmental impact statement.
Yeah, I want to ask you about those. You have, as I count, seven of those, right? You have seven challenges to the environmental impact statement.
Yes. And
our this court's November 10 order directed that you include in your briefs an argument about jurisdiction, right?
Yes.
And you didn't, correct?
Not in the initial brief. We didn't.
Was there a reason for that?
Pardon?
Was there a reason for that? Why didn't you do it?
Primarily because of the page number, the word limitation, and...
But you were under direct order to include a jurisdictional discussion in your opening brief.
We just overlooked it, Your Honor, and we're concerned about getting all of our arguments in the word limit.
And do you know that, I mean, I know you've got 8 pages on it in your reply brief, but are you aware of this circuit's case law that raising arguments in a reply brief for the first time is unacceptable? It's a waiver of the argument?
Well, we were responding to the argument of the NRC and the United States.
But your jurisdictional argument should have been in your opening brief. It's too late to include it in the reply brief, and I didn't even see in your reply brief any explanation for this. Usually when a party waives or fails to that, they put in an argument about trying to explain to the court, well, we had these problems, you know, it's not jurisdictional, but you have none of that. In fact, your reply brief doesn't even acknowledge. The government pointed out in its brief that this court had ordered you to include the jurisdictional analysis in your opening brief. You hadn't done it, and the government says that's sufficient alone for us to dismiss these claims. No response to that in your reply brief.
Of course, the court can address the jurisdiction issue at any time, but we would ask the court to...
Objections to jurisdiction are not forfeitable. Assertions of jurisdiction are forfeitable.
That's my explanation, Your Honor. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Well, why don't you go ahead? Court will decide this question, but you heard my question. It looks to me like just a classic forfeiture of an argument. It's not even that you failed to include it until your reply brief. It's that you were directly ordered to include it in your opening brief. And the government invoked waiver and you didn't respond. It's difficult for me to see how this court can hear any of those claims, challenges to the EIS.
Well, in the few seconds I have left, I would note that we...
Let me just help forward your argument. So you have 6, if that's right, that leaves 6 challenges to the denial of intervention. That's the way I count it. You have 6 separate challenges to the denial of intervention. Which of those do you think, and those are properly before us, which one is your most persuasive?
I was going to argue the transportation issue, Your Honor.
That's the most persuasive?
I believe that's the one that Sierra Club and Goat Waste Michigan both.
Well, why don't you speak about that then?
Sure.
Okay.
Yes. That was Sierra Club's contention number 4. And we presented the expert opinions of Dr. Marvin Resnikoff and Dr. Gordon Thompson. ISP's environmental report, sections 4.2.6 and 4.2.8, did not adequately address those opinions. The environmental report does nothing more than create a dispute justifying an evidentiary hearing, and that's sufficient for a contention to be admitted. We did set forth the standards for admission of contentions. The contention also...
The commission said, as I understand what the commission said about this, it's that, I mean, I get your point. Transportation is a big part of this. But the commission said that ISP had identified a dozen representative routes. And you know where, explain why that analysis was defective. And you haven't said in your brief why that commission finding about the inadequacy of your response was arbitrary and capricious.
There were 2 problems. First of all, there was a claim that transportation issues are irrelevant, and then also that...
What about could you answer my question about the representative routes?
Sure.
Specifically, please respond to that question. You didn't explain, you didn't say to the commission why you thought there was anything wrong with that analysis, right?
I pointed out that that the agency and ISP can't get by with saying, well, we don't know where the routes are going to be because the waste hasn't been shipped yet. But our argument is that it's going to be by rail. We know where the rail lines are. So there's it doesn't take much imagination to know where the impacted communities and individuals will be. And that's why we felt that the commission was wrong in arguing that because the routes haven't been officially designated, that it was okay for ISP to just say that we don't know where the routes are going to be, so therefore we don't have to consider transportation.
Are there any other of these six you want to focus on in your time?
And as far as our contention on the transportation, those are the two main points that I did address the allegations in the environmental report with expert testimony, and that is sufficient for an admission of the contentions, and that the routes are well enough known that we can say that ISP should have done a better job and that the commission should have I should have allowed that contention into evidence.
You're into your rebuttal time, so. You are Mr. Canner for Baskin?
Yes.
Good morning,
Your Honor. Good morning. And may it please the court, Alan Canner for petitioners Baskin Land and Minerals and the Permian Basin Land and Royalty Owners. With court's permission, I've reserved 4 minutes. The NRC erred in denying Baskin's motion to reopen the record and file a new contention based on new information in the DEIS that was not in ISP's environmental report. The information was that the privately titled waste would not involve reimbursement to local government for emergency response and preparedness, as well as for infrastructure improvements. As you know, the original filing was for a DOE-only facility with DOE transportation standards, which are stricter than NRC's general standards. Baskin's new contention was focused on local site-specific impacts and local cost-benefit analysis, which NRC is obligated by its regulations to evaluate. Specifically, we focus most of our new information on the stretch of the Permian Basin within the 50-mile radius of this facility. And the NRC and ISP agree that that route will definitely be used. In that sense, the focus on site-specific information distinguishes our claim from that of the Sierra Club, which is talking about national information. And what we're looking for in the site-specific information is the fact that we don't really fully know what the rules are going to be, but they are obligated to at least explain the local issues with respect to emergency preparedness.
Mr. Canner, why weren't all of your claims ascertainable from the ER, from the environmental report?
It wasn't ascertainable. I mean, I think the assumption was that DOE standards would apply across the board. The DOE transport standards would be utilized across the board.
But the ER
doesn't
say that.
The NRC says we should have seen this.
Right.
We should have seen this coming.
Right. Why?
I think it's just as likely that It would have been the DOE's regulations. And frankly, it's this ascertainability is not a part of the rules that we're dealing with here. They just ask if the language is different. The order we're appealing from the commission specifically says we agree the language is different.
You need to show good cause, right?
Say again?
You need to show good cause.
Yes, it's an elevated
part
standard.
Of that is that the contention wasn't fairly apparent.
Correct.
I don't want to fight over the adjective, but
correct. And we also feel that this was unlike many other NRC proceedings. This was a brand new thing, very unique. CISF. There are regulations for the creation of an ISFSI, such as we have in the Bull Creek case. And they said Congress knew about this. There are also regulations for an MRS. This was new. It was constantly changing. The NRC in its order said, well, we can't stop them from changing the application. So I think that to shift the burden of ascertainability to us, in addition to the other burdens, this doesn't make sense in the context of this language, the pedigree of the program over time.
The environmental report on its face contemplates that this you might have shipments involving DOE waste, or you might have shipments involving private waste. Indeed, the latter one, as we discussed earlier, is the only one that could happen.
Right.
DOE would be responsible, as I understand it, for making the safety arrangements if it's DOE waste, but not otherwise. So why doesn't that pretty clearly signal that someone else is going to have to make arrangements for safe transportation if it's privately owned waste? And if that's not the federal government, who else is it going to be?
I'll tell you exactly why, Your Honor. Congress looked at the issue of transportation in the NWPA. They looked at transportation with respect to taking it to the final repository. This is not that. Congress concluded the title should go to DOE and they should be responsible for transportation. This whole license is predicated on Congress changing the law to allow DOE to put its waste in a privately owned facility and commingle it with privately owned waste, privately titled waste. My position is, why wouldn't that law require DOE to do all the transport? DOE has a slew of regulations that are much stricter than anything NRC has done. But to say that is an unreasonable assumption, and even to get into the subjective state of mind of the people filing contentions, I find inconsistent.
Are you saying there is a legal requirement for DOE to arrange for safe transportation even when the waste is privately owned? Or are you saying that's just so obvious that you couldn't even foresee that the states might have to?
If you were shipping to the final repository, I think we all agree the law is that DOE would do the shipping. I think we also agree that this license has a hypothetical in it. What if Congress passes a law allowing DOE to ship waste? Well, it follows that they would probably have DOE take title to that private waste.
But I mean, it's no secret that we're talking about something other than shipment to the final repository. Yucca Mountain's been on ice for 20 years.
But are we really? I mean, Congress with Yucca Mountain and the NRC, Congress decided it should go to a single-use location, deep geological repository. Mm-hmm. The NRC is now saying we can put this on top of the Permian Basin where oil and gas activities are going on. We can put it basically on a parking lot. We can put these casks on top of the parking lot. I don't know that one could reasonably assume that transportation would be left to private parties. As Your Honor recalls, from Bull Creek, there was a facility that was created. It ultimately was not usable because of different issues, but do you really think any private entity, a utility, would take the risk of shipping its waste? If there's going to be a change in the law, they're going to have DOE do the shipping, just like they did in the NWPA. That is not a far-fetched reading of this application, one that is unique. And so I think a little bit of deference, and ever-changing, as the NRC admits, so a little bit of latitude, I think, is owed to the petitioner who's trying to focus on site-specific issues, which the NRC says are essential in their regulations. There are numerous places where they say that. We raise site-specific issues, and they refuse to hear any of them. All we request is that we have an opportunity to hear this. And one of the problems, Your Honor, you said earlier, and I'm not second-guessing or arguing outside my lane, you suggested, well, we could just excise the DOE part and go forward. The only problem with that is you have to understand the history of this proceeding. It started as a DOE-only facility. When you started commingling private waste, you necessarily created a certain element of confusion. The burden was on ISP or the NRC to clarify for people because NEPA, the Atomic Energy Act, all require that people to have an opportunity to participate. If they're not going to be clear in the first instance, they're not going to be thorough. Because face it, if you're going to file a contention, you're supposed to go to the environmental report, right? You're supposed to look at specific language, object to that language, explain all the information that you're going to use associated with that language. Where would we have pointed to in the environmental report that says, in fact, it would not be money for emergency response preparedness for privately titled waste. And if there's not, that changes the cost-benefit analysis. Right now, the NRC says it's a small to moderate benefit to this area in the Permian Basin to have this facility here, presumably, I guess, taxes or something. Nobody can say that with a straight face. I mean, you read Tommy Taylor's declaration, this is a huge burden. A huge burden on the community.
Thank you. Judge Tatel, anything else? Judge Pan?
No. Nope.
Thank you. We'll give you a minute or two on rebuttal. Let's hear from the government. Whenever you're ready.
May it please the court, my name is Andrew Averbach, the United States Nuclear Regulatory Commission. I appear today on behalf of both the NRC and the United States. Each of the petitions for review in this matter should be dismissed or denied for a variety of reasons, ranging from lack of jurisdiction.
Could you try to speak up?
Yeah, I'm in trouble as well.
Maybe the mic?
Podium adjusts also, if that's easier for you.
Each of the petitions for review should be dismissed or denied for a variety of reasons, ranging from a lack of jurisdiction to a failure to identify, let alone prove, any error by the agency. I'd like to begin today by talking about the court's jurisdiction to review the NRC's petitions.
I just said, before you get into jurisdiction, I just have a factual question. So maybe you can answer it. This site's going to have about 40,000 tons of waste, right? And isn't that right? And there's another one 40 miles away that's going to have more waste. Is that right?
That's generally correct. I would just note that this is the first phase of the first facility, but there is potential for expansion.
Yeah, I understand. Is this all the nation's current nuclear waste from power plants, or a percentage of it?
Huh? It's a substantial percentage. I don't have the exact figures, but it is a lot. And certainly the amount of nuclear waste that gets generated increases over time because of our operating reactors. But this is a substantial amount of fuel that has been generated.
Uh-huh.
Let me begin with jurisdiction, because I think that provides the lens through which to view all the issues that have been presented today. And I'll begin by saying that under the Hobbs Act and the Atomic Energy Act, this court's jurisdiction to review licensing decisions of the NRC, i.e. proceedings in which we granted a license and for which a hearing is available, requires a petitioner first to come to the agency and invoke its adjudicatory proceedings under 10 CFR Part 2. And this court stated in NRDC versus NRC that the way to get to this court is to submit admissible contention. And I'll note that there are sort of two offshoots of it. One is that if you're admitted to the proceeding, then you get to appeal the final license that's issued by the NRC. If you're not, then we're in a situation where you have the immediate right within 60 days of the denial of your request to intervene, you have the right to seek review of the agency decision that denies the request to intervene. And that's what, in the main, the petitioners did with regard to their first wave of petitions. And we don't deny that those petitions for review are properly before the court. But with regard to the second wave, the ones pertaining to the license itself or the EIS, those are not matters that are appealable to this court because the sole remedy for someone who's not admitted as a party is to seek judicial review of the decision denying party status. Now, that has immediate consequences for this case, and it has two sets of immediate consequences. First is that petitions, sort of what I'll refer to as the follow-on petitions that post-date the issuance of the license, those the court should dismiss for lack of jurisdiction. Let me just note with respect to that, that on page 4 of the reply brief, Don't Waste Michigan and Sierra Club do assert that, well, this rule that I've articulated somehow doesn't apply to NEPA claims because the NRDC case didn't involve NEPA. I just want to point out to the court that that's not correct. In fact, the only issue that was before the court in NRDC was a NEPA issue. The court made a statement that I referred to here, talking about how to get to this court, you need to find admissible contention. But the second takeaway from the sets of rules I've articulated and their applicability to this case is that the court review here is confined to the question about whether the agency acted reasonably when it denied admission of various requests to intervene. And when considering that question, we need to understand that what the agency did there was to interpret its own rules concerning contention admissibility, and in particular 10 CFR 2.309, and in applying those rules to the various contentions that have been raised. Now, petitioners have raised a number of arguments in their briefs, and we've heard some of them today as well, suggesting that somehow that the NRC's rules aren't fair. Well, I want to make clear 2 points about that. First, that's not what this case is about. This case is about the application of the NRC's rules to the NRC's application of the rules to this particular set of circumstances. Second of all, this court has repeatedly endorsed the NRC's rules. It has upheld
the responsibility. We understand that.
And I know I promised 2 points, but I'll raise a third one too.
And this argument doesn't address the beyond nuclear arguments or the FASCN.
Well, I think it's fair to say that that question raises a question of law that the agency looked at de novo. And in that sense, we're not talking about a reasonable application of rules. Well, we're not talking about arbitrary and capricious review or abuse of discretion. We're talking about the agency's legal judgment. And I certainly am happy to speak to that if the court has questions about it.
I mean, you can use your time however you want. This is just narrowing the scope of what's before us for one of the three petitioners. So you're going to have to address each of the three pieces anyway.
Let me just finish the jurisdictional point, and then I'll move from one to the next. The idea that's been asserted here that somehow the environmental impact statement is immune from judicial review or comments on the environmental impact statement is immune from judicial review is incorrect. And the reason I say that is because the rules are set up. And again, this is rules that have survived this court's scrutiny.
I'm sorry, I didn't understand what you just said. That somebody's arguing they're immune from judicial review?
The argument has been raised that the NEPA comment process is essentially a dead end for petitioners who seek judicial review of the agency's disposition of those comments. And I want to make clear that that's not the case.
But is your point that we don't have jurisdiction over the challenges to the environmental impact statement?
Correct. That's one of my points.
Yeah. That's your point, right?
Yes. Okay. I'll move on from that then.
Yeah, okay.
Understand.
I think we got that.
Let me begin with beyond nuclear. And I want to make clear that the provision at issue here is not a grant of authority to the NRC to do anything. Rather, it's a restriction on what, and not a grant of authority to the licensee to do anything. It's a restriction on what the licensee is permitted to do. And it's a means of ensuring, as the NRC's mission necessitates, that there is financial assurance provided by the licensee that they're not simply going to walk away, that they're not going to declare bankruptcy tomorrow and leave the nation with stranded waste. So what they've done, or what the agency did, is to address contingencies that may arise, perhaps because Congress decides to revisit this issue, and to make clear that no matter who the title holder is of the fuel that's being stored, that there will be financial assurance provided so as to ensure the public health and safety. And that's what the NRC is in the business of doing. This condition is a means not of granting affirmative authority to do more than what the law provides, but rather to just make sure that there's no concern that the licensee won't have funds to ensure operation.
So I was wondering if the position that you're stating now is also what is reflected in the commission's ruling on this issue. I was just wondering if we owe any deference to an agency's interpretation of its own license, a license that the agency issued. That doesn't seem to fall neatly into any of the deference doctrines, yet it seems to be something that the agency issued. The agency has stated what it meant when it issued the license. And I just am wondering if we owe any deference to that.
I don't know that a traditional deference doctrine applies, but as the court's questioning before, I think, suggests, the NRC will abide by the representations it makes to the court, or that a statement in a judicial decision that we expect the NRC to adhere to its statement made in its commission decision, that it will not authorize the storage of DOE titled fuel if that's illegal, and as long as it's illegal. So in that sense, I think that the commission's statement that this is not permissible is entitled to, is the word.
For the DOE to take title to fuel, would it have to go through the NRC? Would the NRC have to approve that?
DOE to take title to the fuel.
Because you're saying that you would stand by what you said in your license, but I'm wondering if you have any role in that.
I think that there is a technical matter. This is outside the purview of the NRC's jurisdiction as to what DOE is or is not doing. But what I can say is that if the licensee's requirement is to provide proof of contract, and if the contract that it relied on in order to satisfy the condition were illegal, the NRC would say, no, you can't give this to us. This isn't enough. You can't be, you need to have financial assurance, and proof of financial assurance via an instrument that's illegal doesn't satisfy your obligation.
So that would have to go through the NRC again if there were actually a contract?
It wouldn't have to go through the NRC, but the NRC would enforce, pursuant to its enforcement program, requirements of all licensees.
So you're saying somebody would sue, and then it would come before the NRC? Would say that's not.
That's one vehicle. I think another vehicle is a suit by someone who doesn't like this outcome under the Nuclear Waste Policy Act. There's a specific judicial review provision of the NWPA, and if someone wanted to make the assertion that, hey, DOE, you can't do that, it wouldn't necessarily be a case against the NRC, but there would certainly be judicial recourse in that circumstance.
Even apart from the question of who might bring what lawsuit, your position is that notwithstanding the reference to government-owned waste in this condition, it would not be presently lawful for this licensee to make arrangements with regard to government-owned nuclear waste.
That's correct, Your Honor. And the one point I'll make, too, in response to Judge Pan's question earlier, is that I think it is fair to say that the central premise of this license, as it's been presented to the agency, and that the agency has based its evaluation on, is in fact that it will be storing spent fuel from or to which private entities, i.e. NRC reactor licensees, currently own title and will continue to hold title. And if one were to look at, for example, the purpose and need statement in the environmental impact statement, you can see this is on page JA-1070. You can see that the way that the agency has analyzed the project is in response to the demand of private fuel owners to have an off-site place to store spent fuel. We're not talking about DOE taking title, we're talking about private licensees doing something with the fuel that they currently own title to and continue to own title to until and unless that changes.
So do you agree with my prior line of questioning about focusing on the contention itself and its framing of what the central premise is? If we agree that this is not the central premise, isn't that reason in itself to uphold what the commission did in this case?
I think that's a fair conclusion, yes, Ron. It's one of several, but it's certainly one of the ways the court would rule, and we would have no objection.
And if we ruled that way, would we have to address all the ins and outs of this potentially illegal application of the license?
I don't think the court would, no.
Because there was a statement that we would still have to decide the motion to dismiss, and then we'd still have to get into these issues. What do you think of that?
I don't know that the court, I mean, first of all, let me back up on the motion to dismiss. There hasn't actually been any briefing about what the agency did wrong vis-a-vis the motion to dismiss.
So I'm sorry, there hasn't what?
Hasn't been any briefing or any argument from Beyond Nuclear about, although they referenced the resolution of the motion to dismiss mm-hmm. as one of the items that they're seeking review of, they haven't, in their brief, argued what it is that the agency did incorrectly.
Oh, I see.
Now, we referred those arguments to the licensing board because that seemed like the appropriate thing to do. These are issues that we want to be able to adjudicate. The way we adjudicate things is through our 10 CFR Part 2 process. So it seemed, and the motion to dismiss isn't even something that's contemplated by the NRC's regulations. So in an effort to accommodate, is the best word, arguments that had been raised and to give persons an opportunity to be heard, we channeled those arguments to the NRC's adjudicatory process. I plan on moving to the next phase unless the court has additional questions about Beyond Nuclear.
Yeah, that probably makes sense.
Let me move to the FASCN. And the general theme of what I'd like to say is simply that the agency acted reasonably in ruling as it did that the contention that had been raised was both untimely because the various facts that had been represented as new were in fact either A, not new, or B, certainly ascertainable from the existing record, and that B, even if these arguments had been timely raised, they still wouldn't present an admissible contention. Let me focus on the latter half first. I heard Mr. Tanner say earlier that the focus of the arguments that he wanted to make and that distinguished his claim from those presented by Sierra Club and Don't Waste Michigan and that had already been addressed by the commission were somehow pertaining to the local flavor of the impacts that were going to be experienced in terms of transportation to and from the interim storage facility. The fact that FASCN has identified that somehow opened FASCN's eyes to new information here isn't a fact that has to do with local impacts or localized impacts. Rather, this is at page 4-74 of the EIS, which is JA-1070. This comes in as a part of a discussion about nationwide what the impacts of transportation to and from a consolidated interim storage facility will be. And it's talking about national impacts, or the impacts on the nationwide shipment of spent fuel from Maine, or Washington State, or Florida to Texas. And what's interesting about that is that discussion has nothing to do with Texas or with New Mexico or anything like that. It's about a nationwide shipping. And in fact, the page of the draft EIS that was the basis for the motion to admit new information, which is page 4-75, actually says two things. And they're rather interesting because they illustrate that there's really no contention here to be raised or any problem that's been identified underneath it. The first statement is that, well, we actually don't expect any additional significant costs to be incurred for emergency planning or emergency preparedness along this nationwide travel network, because in fact, those emergency preparedness costs are already being incurred by various states and municipalities as a consequence of the existing radioactive and hazardous traffic, hazardous shipment traffic across the nation. So we don't actually incur, don't actually expect any additional costs. So to the extent that the assertion here is that, oh, there are going to be more costs, well, that's belied by the text of the provision itself that FASN is relying on. The second point is really just that all the that statement does, the statement that talks about what will happen if, in terms of alleged additional costs, what it's really saying is that, oh, we just want to point out that in the event that DOE were the shipper, i.e. in the event that we're talking about a national shipping campaign to Yucca Mountain, there would be grants available under the NWPA, the Nuclear Waste Policy Act, and these aren't NWPA shipments, so therefore there will be no additional grants. Those aren't costs of this project. It's just pointing out that unlike a national shipping campaign to Yucca Mountain, these are going to be costs incurred, these will be costs that'll be incurred by the shippers themselves with federal grants. So essentially, there's no federal windfall, no federal backup, nothing more. And certainly not a cost or a deficiency in cost analysis related to this particular project. Let me briefly reference some of the arguments that Don't Waste Michigan and Sierra made. Mr. Taylor referred to the arguments concerning transportation as the most important ones for the court to consider. But what I'd like to point out is simply that the argument to this court is simply that, well, the agency should have provided more, should have agreed more with the conclusions that his experts or the experts that he cited, rather than, and in particular, should have adopted the worst case scenario analysis that had been prepared in connection with the Yucca Mountain map, and that it's somehow error for the agency to go with a different analysis. But that's not an recognizable criticism of an EIS, either before the agency or before this court.
If we were reviewing the merits of the EIS and it had said, agency had said, we have all these studies and we don't find credible the competing study, or we're not going to do a worst case analysis or whatever, and we're reviewing for arbitrariness, you win, no doubt. But this is a different posture. Here, the question is, what did that study create a genuine dispute of material fact, which seems to mirror summary judgment language, just for the limited purpose of being admitted into the record? And if you think of it that way, and you posit different studies reaching different conclusions, and if the right analogy is to summary judgment standards in civil litigation, it should come in.
Two points, Your Honor. First, I don't think that that's quite the proper analogy, and the commission
I'm not sure it is. I was just struck by the language in the reg that seemed patterned on Rule 56.
It's similar to, but I think it's important to stress that it's not. And the commission has, and this is in the same set of cases that have upheld the commission's contention admissibility standards. It wanted to make clear that a petitioner or an intervener has a burden that's more stringent than summary judgment in order to raise contention before the agency. And again, those rules have been addressed and challenged on appeal and confirmed. But what the commission's precedents have indicated, and this is what we cite in our brief, and also what this court's precedents have indicated, is that when you're coming in challenging an analysis on an environmental impact statement, it's not enough to just say, well, you should accept my people and disregard yours. You have to come in and actually say, what is wrong? Why would it be unreasonable for the agency to rely on the analysis that, in this case, the applicant provided? Why would it be wrong for the agency to rely, to demonstrate why it would be wrong for the agency to rely on the analysis in final environmental impact statement? You have to come in and say it would be unreasonable because of XYZ reason. You have to come in and say that I have someone who knows what they're talking about, most usually an expert, saying that this analysis is inaccurate or that it's flawed to a point where it's unreasonable.
Judge Tatel, anything further? Judge Pan?
No.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. May it please the court, Brad Fagg for intervener, Interim Storage Partners. Just a handful of things to go over. First, just a little bit of elaboration on your question, Judge Tatel, about the amount. And it is true that 40,000 MTUs, metric tons of uranium, ultimately, potentially, if all phases play out. This particular license is 5,000 MTUs, and the joint appendix at 1969 identifies that. So just that as a threshold.
Still seems like a big number, but go ahead.
A few words about the Nuclear Waste Policy Act arguments. This license is not and should not be a mechanism to enforce DOE's compliance with the Nuclear Waste Policy. If DOE were to do what the petitioners are concerned about, enter into a contract with utilities or with ISP that they say violates the Nuclear Waste Policy Act, there is a ready-made mechanism to challenge that. The Nuclear Waste Policy Act itself contains judicial review provisions. There's a number of cases out there, but the Alabama Power case in the 11th Circuit, 307 F3rd 1300, is one of those. Almost the same situation here. DOE entered into a contract there involving compensation. Allegations were that it violated the act, and the 11th Circuit ultimately struck that down. That mechanism is in place. In response to some discussion about SEVR, you know, should we just eliminate this issue? Two reasons to not do that. One, it's not illegal for all the reasons we've described. This is not an authorization to do anything. This is a restriction on what can be done under this license. And secondly, it makes no sense. You know, some of the amicus, both NEI and even the NRDC, talk about all the bills that are floating around out there. You know, I get these alerts. It's too many to count.
I'm sorry, the what?
The bills introduced into Congress that are floating around. The possibility, I don't think anybody in this courtroom would disagree that the nuclear waste program in the United States is broken, but there's always and continues to be efforts potential to change that landscape. This was a years-long process, an expensive process. And if magically, or not so magically, but something happens to change the landscape to say, well, okay, now you got to go back and do it all over again, makes no sense. And again, because of the lack of illegality and the lack of sensibility, we don't think there should be any blue penciling going on with respect to the license. Final point on the Nuclear Waste Policy Act, there was some discussion about going back to the motion to dismiss and the original contentions. We did talk about that in some measure at pages 17 to 18 of our brief, of the Interim Storage Partners brief, and at the joint appendix at page 40 is the commission's treatment of that motion to dismiss. It was procedurally improper. So for that reason alone, if that's all that's left of the Nuclear Waste Policy Act arguments, that's yet another of what we think are many mechanisms to reject that part of the challenges here. Moving from that, unless there's any questions about the Nuclear Waste Policy Act, to the NEPA sort of violations, I think it's important to emphasize the standards here. In these types of cases, everyone always sorts of recites the standards review and then moves on. But when you look at, I think, and with all due respect, fairly, the allegations that are being made here, all of the things that are recited about the deferential standards review. NEPA is a series of judgment calls, the Duncan's Point case cited by the government. NEPA determinations are only reversible for a clear error of judgment. These are just disagreements about, we wish you had done it a different way. This isn't the agency said black and the facts are white. Okay, this is judgment calls, and I think, and I would like to emphasize that the traditional deference applied in these sorts of situations is outcome determinative.
I take your point, but what's your answer to my question that all of that said, the bar should be a good bit lower when the question is simply whether the submission should be admitted into the record?
Two responses to that, if I may, Your Honor. First, I would agree with a government counsel. By design, it's not a summary judgment bar. It's not a low bar.
It's a by design. And then secondly, the rules are not on trial here. Okay, the NRC's rules have been ratified over and over and over again by this court. There's a way that you can challenge those rules. You can petition for a rulemaking. Or, you know, there's all sorts of ways to do that. But the only thing that's at issue in this case is whether the agency reasonably applied its rules. And the rules, we suggest, are crystal clear. And when you frame it in that way, I think, again, the deference owed to the agency here is very unlike the sort of, well, is there an issue of fact? Is there a possibility for disagreement? That is not the standard. So moving on from the standards, I really just had one more point with respect to the FASCN arguments. Mr. Kaner asked, well, how was I to know? How was I to know that there might be private storage here, private transportation here without the backing of DOE funding? Well, the answer to that is in the environmental report itself. It's at page 767 of the joint appendix. And that talks about if DOE is involved, there'll be funding. Obviously, it's crystal clear from that recitation that that wasn't the only type of potential transportation scheme. So, unless there are further questions, those are the points I wanted to make. And thank you.
Yep. Thank you.
Thank you. I'd like to make 2 points. In response to Judge Pan, I just wanted to clarify that we do not concede that our contention was properly dismissed. The issue of ownership and responsibility for the cost of storing spent fuel is central, that the inclusion of any language in that license condition has to be read. All language is central to that license condition. It may be the most important thing in a license. Who gets the bill for this spent fuel if there are problems with this facility? And I think NRC would agree this is an extraordinarily important matter.
And so if I can ask you then, like, the language was the central premise of ISP's application is that the U.S. Department of Energy will be responsible for the spent fuel that is transported to and stored at the proposed interim facility.
And that's absolutely true, Your Honor. The way
But this ignores that there's an alternative way to do it, which is through the privately owned.
As long as the DOE is in there, you must assume that the DOE will be the owner.
That's why? Why must I assume that?
Because that is how the license is written. Or means it could be one party or it could be the other. And it's just as likely to be the federal government, the way this license is written. All of the assertions about how this isn't going to happen are outside the scope of the license.
There are two alternatives. One is lawful, one is unlawful, presently unlawful. Why would we assume that that will shake out with the unlawful alternative?
Because the administrative procedure...
Especially since that's what the government has told us.
Why should we rely? Why is the NRC issuing a license it knows has an unlawful provision? That's the first question. Why are we having to litigate whether it's okay to put unlawful language in a license and say, no problem here? As Mr. Fagg said, why would we, you know, why waste our time?
So I
understand. Amend a license.
I understand your position, but I think that you did not reflect your position in your contention. So I think that your contention fails on its face.
Ron, I respectfully disagree because every term in that license is central. The DOE, the fact that there's
then what's the point
language
of saying central?
In a license doesn't excuse the unlawful language. That is also clearly established in the court. All of the language in the license must be considered central.
Well, why would you use the word central if every word is central?
Because it is a central issue in this license. Who gets liability for this spent fuel? That is one of the important conditions in the license.
Okay.
And I would just...
Oh, thank you, Mr. Kern.
Could I add one more?
Briefly.
Point. To Judge Tato, as why can't we rely on the assurances of the court that you would not let this condition be fulfilled. Again, it begs the question as to why we're jumping over hurdles to legitimate the unlawful land.
We understand that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
I can hopefully clarify Judge Cassis's questions about whether this is like summary judgment or not. It is not. The contention admission process is more like notice pleading and a motion to dismiss.
You think it's even a lower burden?
Pardon?
You think the burden is even lower in this context?
Oh, yes. And in fact, the NRC regs provide for a summary disposition after the contention is admitted and there's some record made.
What do you do with the cases? I'm just looking at the cases cited at page 52 of the red brief. And we have a fair number of cases suggesting that even at this admissibility stage, the proponent of the evidence has to not merely suggest other ways this might have been done, but point to a deficiency.
Well, first of all, I think we did more than that by presenting our expert testimony our evidence we presented. We have put in our initial brief under the standard of review cases from the agency itself, indicating that the NRC has determined that the burden on a petitioner in stating its contentions is not heavy. Simply insisting upon some reasonably specific factual and legal basis for the contention, and that the petitions are required only to articulate at the outset the specific issues they wish to litigate. The petitioner only needs to come forward with factual issues, not merely conclusory statements and vague allegations. And there is a Supreme Court case we cited, Vermont Yankee versus NRDC, that says that the intervener simply must make a showing sufficient to require reasonable minds to inquire further. I think we've done that. And just as the court can rule on a motion to dismiss at the pleading stage, I think you can rule here. I think you have the jurisdiction to do that. Thank you.
Judge Taylor.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. A fair reading of the FASTN contention would include all of the information contained in the Taylor affidavit, the motion itself, as well as the words of the contention itself. It does have a local flavor. We focus primarily on local issues. What the NRC is saying is, but we don't deny that there are some national facts here. Remember, the environmental report and the EIS talk about safe transportation nationwide. We're not talking about local situation. And they do it based on DOE shipments. 100%.
Can I ask you about that? Because looking at JA-767, the environmental report says, if the DOE is the shipper, the federal government through DOE is responsible for providing emergency training to states, tribes, and local emergency responders along the transportation routes where SNF would be transported to the CISF. So isn't that by implication if DOE is not the shipper? I mean, this leaves that open. So why isn't that ascertainable to you? Why didn't you raise this in response to the environmental report?
Okay, fair enough. It's not, because if DOE does this and they say nothing about the other scenario, and if all of the safety data is based on DOE shipments in the past, then I don't think a reasonable person should read into the if all of this other stuff.
But the implication is DOE isn't always the shipper. If DOE is a shipper, this happens. And
no.
I think it's ascertainable that there may be instances where DOE is not the shipper. Why are you not on notice that that could happen?
I think it's ascertainable that there privately titled waste will be shipped. But the question is, who will ship it? and under what standards. Nothing is said in the DEIS or the environmental report other than referencing these studies based on DOE shipping standards, which I think we all agree are elevated to what the NRC could do, but we haven't been told what they're going to do here. I don't think it goes that far. And I think that the issue focuses on the information, there's no reference to ascertainability in the order. The order that I'm appealing specifically says, we agree, the language is different. So let's just talk about two things. Let's talk about material differences, and let's talk about the local emergency issues being beyond the scope of what we're doing. And I think that's what we focus on, and we need to focus on here. I would say that the agency can't ignore its own site-specific rules. And finally, this whole premise is the agency ignoring all of its rules about ISFSIs, all of its rules about MRSs, creating a new situation to move virtually all the nation's SNF into two facilities without any of the security that we would have had at a place like Yucca Mountain. And they do it with this whole new thing that keeps changing. That's extraordinary, I think, by any. And it's worth noting, every single contention was rejected in this case. That's unprecedented. Over 2,800 comments were basically ignored because the final EIS didn't reflect any changes from the original DIS. That is not how the agency and the public deserve to have this kind of decision made. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks to all counsel. The case is submitted.